committee that is on House Oil and Gas. It's currently 3:06 p.m. on Tuesday, the 20th of March. With us, we have Representatives Dugan, Samuels, Vice Chair Olson, Representative Kawasaki, and my name is Vic Corin, the Chair of the committee. I welcome everybody here, and thank you for attending and for your participation. And good to see the members of the administration here as well. I want to recognize Representative Gatto, co-chair of the Resources Committee, that will be hearing this bill once we move it out of this committee. Thanks for your participation as well. You can join us too, Carl, if you'd like. And if I've missed anybody else, legislative-wise, my regrets. We're here today, of course, to continue on with the sectional analysis from the Department of Law. And we heard most of that on, today's Tuesday. It seems like days ago, but I guess it was yesterday. So much is going on. So we're going to hear the rest of the sectional analysis. And as before, I welcome the committee members to interrupt me and the presenter if you have any questions or comments that you wish to make. And my guess is we'll probably be able to expedite this thing since we got through most of the analysis yesterday. If it is the preference of committee members, because we only had a partial committee yesterday at a certain point, we can back up a little bit, or we can just pick up where we left off. Is there anybody have any thoughts on that? Okay, well, not to put you guys on the spot, but...
Why don't we start at the beginning?
Yeah. We'll start at the beginning and just take 3 hours going through this again? Okay, we won't do that. I'll spare you the punishment then, okay?
January 16th, is that...
Yeah, really. So, okay, with that, I'd like to call the folks in the administration forward and continue on where we left off yesterday afternoon and finish out with this analysis. And do you recall where we left off? I don't. I have it on page 17.
But Representative Dugan remembered, so...
I believe we're on page 17, where it's Article 4 miscellaneous provisions. Did I say that right?
Correct. Okay. Absolutely.
I think that's right.
I'm amazed at myself here. I have to remember that. Okay, go ahead.
For the record,
please. I hate to do this to you, but could you start with, the coordinator again? I missed
sure,
the entire coordinator.
Absolutely. Does anybody else have any requests as far as where you would like to begin, or is that okay? Okay, we'll start with coordinator.
Okay, at the bottom, for the record, my name is Marcia Davis, Deputy Commissioner for Department of Revenue. At the bottom of page 16, section 330, is the provision that provides for the creation of a Alaska Gasline Inducement Act coordinator. And this position would be appointed by the governor and serve at the pleasure of the governor until 1 year after commencement of commercial operations of the project. And the job of this person is to essentially ensure that state agencies and the permitting and regulatory oversight required by state agencies comply with the other portions of AGEA, specifically section 340, which we'll get to in a second.
Mike?
I'm fine, thank you.
I thought we had a question. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
In addition, this position would coordinate with the federal coordinator for the project as well. Section 340.
Representative Samuels.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The language somewhat looks familiar with the federal, and that's what it was.
It is.
Patterned after the federal, just kind of cut through the red tape once you get to the point where there will be red tape. That's the point of it.
Yes, Representative Samuels, through the chair. This section, 330 and 340, were modeled after the federal pipeline coordinator positions.
And this coordinator then doesn't answer to one of the two commissioners, and the coordinator answers directly to the governor.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Section 340 at the top of page 17 outlines the requirements that AGEA imposes on state agencies and their approval and regulatory oversight of matters relating to the pipeline. And again, these were modeled after the federal requirements. They essentially require expeditious handling of permits. They also essentially require that no terms and conditions would impair the project unless they are specifically required by state law. And the same with regard to amendments, abrogations of certificates, right-of-way permits, et cetera, that where there might be discretionary authority, unless it's specifically required by law, it's not permitted. Under Article 4, Section 400, this is the section of miscellaneous provisions. Section 400 provides for the procedural mechanism for placement of the matching contribution for the pipeline inducement fund. Section 410 provides the authorization for the commissioners to issue and implement regulations to implement a GEO.
Excuse me, ma'am.
Thanks.
President Samuels?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I don't know if it's a revenue question or a DNR question, but last year during PPT, we specifically left things open so that the regulators could determine the qualified expenditures. That was the point, so that the regulators would do it. And this year, we've already had one statute change come in defining expenditures. So is there going to be a problem if say, that when the bill passes and then the regulations come out, so DNR has the regulations in place saying that this does or does not count, and then along comes the legislature and says, oh, well, we disagree with you on that, and you're kind of changing the rules for the licensee, does that become a problem for both the licensee and the entire project? You can't lock this into a constitutional test, but you have to remember, looking back to PPT, mm-hmm. we specifically left it up to the commissioners, and now we have come back already with one and who knows how many more over the next number of years. And I guess it might be a question more for DNR with the qualified expenditures, but do you see that as being a concern? That's you, okay.
I was going to say, for what is a qualified expenditure, we've got the regulations, I mean, the statute, we've defined what qualified expenditures are, and in terms of the benefit that flows through to is to the pipeline company, and so it's going to be incorporated in their license, so it will have a contractual structure to it, and that's what gives it the protection, constitutional protection, that whereas under the PPT, just as a statewide law, it didn't have that.
Thank you. I just wanted to bring it up. Thanks.
Yeah.
Let me recognize a couple more folks, and no disrespect intended to commissioners, but we do have two distinguished guests here, Commissioner Galvin of Revenue and Commissioner Irwin of Resources, and we've been joined also by Guttenberg, pronounced his name right for once. Sorry for butchering your name in the past, and Johnson. And Craig, you're welcome to join us too if you'd like, all right? Feel free.
Just a little bit to be here.
Okay. Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The language on the establishment of the Alaska Gasline Inducement Act Matching Contribution Fund, this is a non-lapsing operating budget fund. Am I reading that correctly?
As opposed to, it's not a capital fund, so it's a non-lapsing fund that's available to be used for the purposes established under the Act.
Does anybody at this table know? Can we do that?
I don't know.
It's honesty. Through our Department of Law, when they establish, I mean, we basically turn it over to them to put together the language for establishing this fund. So we can have somebody from Department of Law talk to that issue and give you some further information about the precedent on this type of arrangement.
Right. You understand I'm not skeptical. I'm just asking a question whether or not this can actually be done under the constitutional provisions on dedicated funds. So.
Right.
Do we have three individuals online? Are either one of those able to address that, do you think? We've got Paris.
Well, I can ask Bonnie Paris is online.
Hello, Bonnie.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, ma'am. We hear you loud and clear. Identify yourself for the record, please.
Bonnie Harris, Senior Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law.
Okay.
Our office drafted Section 43.90.400, and I guess in answer to Mr. Dugan's question, I would say you can do this. This is real similar to provisions already in statute for the Alaska State Housing Authority, the Alaska Ferry System, transportation provisions. So it does not create a dedicated fund problem. This is the fund into which the legislature appropriates money for the matching contribution. If that doesn't answer the question, I'll take more questions if you'd like.
We seem to be okay at this point. Thank you very much, Bonnie. We've been joined by Representatives Ramirez and Dahlstrom as well. Thank you very much. We've got a full contingent here. That's great. So proceed, please.
Section 420 on page 18 is the statute of limitations section, and this is designed to ensure prompt and speedy legal review and resolution of any constitutionality questions. And under this section, a lawsuit must be filed within 90 days from the date that the license is issued if it seeks to challenge the constitutionality of the act or a license that's issued. Section 430 is a provision providing for interest, which ensures that any monies owed to the state are paid with interest and establishes the rate for that interest. Section 440 is the license project assurance section. This section is the piece that we consider the fiscal stability section for the project, the pipeline builders. And under this provision, this is essentially the state's commitment that once it awards it a license to a licensee, and that licensee has begun to expend its funds in reliance upon that award and in contemplation of the upcoming inducements coming into play for producers to commit their gas to their open season, this ensures that the state doesn't midway respond to another pipeline proposal and extend benefits, financial benefits, to another pipeline that would draw away the expected support for the original licensee. Mm-hmm. And while it only applies to a competing natural gas pipeline project, and so we've already had some questions previously, and there may be questions here on what that means. In addition, it's three times what it entitles the original licensee to is if the state does in fact reach that condition and does extend financial benefit to a competing pipeline project, it entitles the original licensee to three times its costs incurred to the point in time that initial favorable treatment was extended to the other group. So it kind of cuts off at that point. The condition happens. We owe three times the costs incurred to that point in time. It also essentially treats that original license as having been abandoned, and it entitles the state to receive assignment of all of the product, the work product, and basically developed by the licensee to that point in time. And what that means is if the state did get wooed, decide to jump ship for another project at that point in time, this becomes the cost of that transaction that would have to be built in, and the legislature would have to evaluate that in deciding whether extending favorable treatment to another project was financially worth our while.
Mm-hmm. Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. Can we go back to 420 for a minute?
Mm-hmm.
This is a limit, the ability to challenge the Constitution. Is it possible to actually limit somebody's right to challenge the Constitution?
I guess I would defer that question to Bonnie. Bonnie, you're on the phone? Department of Law.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Bonnie Harris, did you hear the question?
I didn't hear the entire question. Okay. Would you mind having it repeated,
sure,
please?
We'll have Representative Guttenberg repeat his question.
Thank
please.
You. In Section 420 on page 18, we're putting a statute of limitations on somebody's ability to bring a challenge to the constitutionality of this chapter. Can you actually limit somebody's right to challenge the Constitution?
Well, the answer is probably no and yes.
She's a lawyer.
It's defensible to put limitations on rights of action. Whether a court would sustain a limitation on the right to bring a constitutional action is not certain. So this provision, while it does address the constitutionality of the statute, it's conceivable that if a constitutional claim were raised after this period, a court would still entertain it. However, it would give the two departments, the ability to argue for enforcement of the statute.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Go ahead, Marcia.
Okay. Section 450 on page 19 relates to assignments. And because we definitely anticipate some fluidity in the identity of the participants in a project over the project life, we wanted to ensure that we address the ability of a licensee, original licensee, to assign all or part of the license, as well as the ability of producers who receive the inducements related to their resource. Part A addresses the transfer of the license, and it allows that transfer if it's approved in writing and advanced by the commissioners, and that license transfer does not increase or diminish the obligations created by the license to the state. The transfer of the royalty inducement, because we didn't want to create an odd sort of secondary market in the sale of these types of benefits, particularly on the tax side, because it can be very, for the royalty side as well, it can be very expensive administratively to track that if it's severed from the resource. We've allowed that transfer, but only in connection with the transfer of all of the assets of that individual held on the North Slope. Section 460 deals with conflicting laws. Again, fairly standard boilerplate.
Excuse me, we have a question. Mm-hmm. Representative Samuels.
Thank you. On 440, on the essentially the exclusivity, when you had discussions internally, was there a way to, I understand the competitive aspect of the legislation, and that's good, but is there a way to get further and still have the competition going during the design phase? And was that discussed internally? I mean, if you have all of the things that we want over here, you want the rolled-in tariffs and all of these things, the timeline on the open season and all that stuff. If you get all that stuff, it's now a race for the gas. Internally, did you have discussions on having two projects competing going down the road, even where you could have two both qualified, rather than picking a winner at the front end, kind of see how things went as you go down the road, and if one clearly became better, the TransCanada Conoco deal became better than the Mid-America BP deal, rather than picking the winner at the beginning and going with what at the end of the day might have been a worse choice, and then you killed everybody right off the bat, and instead of letting them all kind of grow together, was there a way that you thought of to try to? And that's a true competition, that you're racing for the gas. Everybody that follows, anybody that does what we want them to do, we don't care who owns it, but you're racing to get to the successful open season.
Our initial idea was similar to the federal statute, which is you set out your what you're willing to give, and it is something that they receive once they actually have the project and they're going forward. And what we ended up having to recognize in our discussions with the commercial folks out there who were trying to get involved in this project to create that sense of competition was that there was a desire, the reflection that we got back was they wanted the state to put something up front to give them a sense that the state was really going with a particular project, and to give them the sense that they're not going to end up putting their money in and basically have somebody else swoop in who has more political clout within the state and just sweep it away at the last minute just because this other party put the money in and moved the project far enough to change the dynamic. It was basically a reflection of what we experienced in the negotiations over the last few years, the sense of being a stalking horse, the sense of being used strictly as window dressing and being used as leverage to get a better deal from the producers. And so in order to get that sense of the state really is in this with somebody and isn't just using this as a way to get a better deal from somebody else, there needed to be a bit more of a commitment up front, and that's what ended up driving us to the model that you see here. We tried interim steps, try to build a staged kind of competition, and each one of them had different problems, either structurally or in terms of whether it would actually provide much of an incentive for anybody to participate. And so in the end, where we ended up with this, as you can see from the model that we have, it's we want everybody to give us your best shot up front, and we're going to go with somebody, and that person we're going to stick with to the end. And so we want them to give us their full picture, and that's why we have the the connection with this licensee is going to carry us not just through that initial open season, but carry us all the way through that goal of getting the certificate and not be a jumping-off point, say, at an open season. Well, you got us here, but it didn't work out, so now we're going to let somebody else take it from here. We wanted to be able to get somebody actually in that initial door, and to do so, the word that we got back was, we need to know that we can actually get to the finish line with you.
Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So if I understand this section and the section about transferability or whatever we're calling it here.
Assignment,
thank you. In some ways, this license becomes an economic asset because it assumes that it can either be sold or the state can buy the license holder out under some conditions. Is that correct?
When you combine the abandonment, you combine the damages, you combine the what we're calling the assurances. There's different ways in which we recognize that as we move forward, the commercial dynamic's going to change, and we need to provide opportunities for that dynamic to shape the project. But throughout, on each of those sections, the state has the final say on whether or not we're going to pursue that, with the caveat that at each juncture, the state's value has to remain. And the purpose of that is really to protect competition, that we don't want somebody to come in the door with a project and have the project that basically comes in second watches this other project, says, oh, actually, we have a problem here, we're going to have to change it, and then they diminish their project to a point where this first project would have been better. And that's why we have the caveat in there with the value.
Follow-up, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to make sure that I understand this, Commissioner. So the state could award the license to Company A, which at some point could sell the license to Company B, provided that sale meets the requirements that are outlined in the bill. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Thank you.
And also, just to complete the picture, what we think is the more likely scenario is Company A gets the license, and down the road, Company B wants to come in with a 20% interest, and they ask if they can bring in Company B for whatever reason, and they tell the state that this will add value or this will be a good thing, and we agree to do that.
I see. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman. Welcome.
Article 5 contains the definitions. And essentially all of the words that are listed here as defined are terms that have appeared more than once throughout the statute. What our drafters attempted to do is where a term was only used in one location, its definition would reside within that section, such as engineering increments and some of those other types. Section 990 on page 21 contains the short title. And then the sections of the Act, Section 2, Section 3, Section 4, are conforming amendments, which are essentially amendments of other statutes that have to be made in order to ensure that this Act is consistent with existing law. And Section 5 contains the effective date, which would be immediately after passage.
Okay. Representative Gower.
Can the state at will take the project back and award three times the value invested, or do we have to have some overriding reason that a court would accept?
The way that one project, the statute is written right now, no, it would not allow us to simply at will. That would not activate that clause. We would actually need to extend favorable financial treatment to a competing gas line project. If we wanted to take it back for reasons because we believe that the project was uneconomic, then we would go to the other section within the statute where one of two parties is alleging that the project is uneconomic and activate the third-party arbitration provisions.
I think the more practical answer to your question is if the state decides that it wants to end this license, we would tell the licensee, look, we're done with it. The licensee would say, hey, If that's the case, we think that under the terms of this license, we should get three times our investment. Would there be some sort of negotiation and something would work out?
Perhaps a lawsuit.
We would be obligated to create a phantom law to give benefit to a phantom project just to get that provision exercised. I mean, there'd be a way to get out. Our maximum cost is that three times is one way to look at it.
Anything else? Reverend Nugent?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just the phrase commissioners means the Commissioner of Revenue and the Commissioner of Natural Resources acting jointly. Reminds me of this question. Have there been provisions in here for what happens if the commissioners don't agree?
No.
So do we anticipate like an arm wrestling contest?
Well, Tom's sitting behind me.
Let's have a preview.
I have to look.
Yeah, can we see how it would work?
I think he's got strength. I've got age.
Oh, there they go. Look out. In this body, we use a flip of a coin.
I'm sorry. I didn't.
The way we view this is that having the commissioners act jointly is basically means that our two departments, with our own expertise, would work together to come up with a resolution. If we have different decisions, then the governor would make the final call since we both report to the governor. And so it's intended to be the administration would ultimately have to make a decision speaking in one voice as opposed to one commissioner basically telling the other commissioner, I don't care what your guys say, we're going to do it this way.
Representative Dugan through the chair. It's interesting because this question was appropriately asked in the Senate Resources yesterday also, and we've all been used to the establishment of military, someone has to be in control, business, someone makes the decision. I think in this case it's very good for the and healthy for the state to have a tension, if necessary, between the two commissioners. We have very skilled people in modeling on both sides, and I think the state's well served if we resolve the issue, come up with the same answer. If not, we've got our both sets of data. As Commissioner Galvin said, we go to the governor. But don't forget, we're also accountable to this body, to the Senate body, and to the Alaskan public. And that tension or compatibility, however the numbers shake out, is good for the state.
Just for the record, that was Commissioner Irwin. Oh,
thank you,
sir. Representative Elstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dugan, last week, one of the questions that you had and I had a response to you brought up the possibility of creating a panel, a commission, a board, or something to overview, and I had raised the issue of, instead of doing that, maybe having another, you know, commissioner be involved in the process. But hearing this explanation today and doing a study that I've done since we had that last meeting, I'm satisfied with the explanation that we have, and knowing that because of that healthy tension that does exist and that the governor would make the final decision based on the data. I think neither one of us, I think our worry and our concern is good, but I don't think either one of us need to worry about doing an amendment on those issues. I mean, that's my feeling. I'm satisfied with that.
Good point. I concur with you. Yes, Representative Dugan.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to make sure that the traditional tie-breaking method in the executive branch was still the tie-breaking piece of legislation. Thank you.
You're welcome. Representative Ramirez?
I think this show, my apologies for being
no problem.
Late to the committee. Commissioner Galvin, I'm always surprised how quickly amendments come up. We take up the legislation and bam, we suddenly we're in amendments, and I don't like to do them on the fly. I like to be a little bit prepared. When you made the initial presentation to us and we looked at some of the stylized numbers, $20.5 billion cost for the pipeline, and then your office was so helpful in coming back with a worksheet showing cost overruns, $2.4, $6, $8, $10 billion. And then the next interest that I had that I discussed with Representative Dahlstrom, and I have some interest in doing in amendment form, is increasing the equity stake in the project by putting in to the legislation through amendment the opportunity for the Arm Board and or the Permanent Fund Division and or the university's retirement program to enjoy a regulated return on increasing the equity in the project. It went, you know, 70-30, and another $2 billion, for instance, would move it to roughly 65-35, notwithstanding the cost overrun. And that would allow the permanent fund to have $1 billion invested in the pipeline. It would allow the ARM board, if you will, Mr. Chairman, to have $1 billion invested in the pipeline. And so what I've been looking at, and the help that I'd like to have in creating an additional worksheet from the Department of Revenue, please, is how much the tariff is moved 9 cents when you move the equity stake from 30% to 35%. A 5% equity stake would represent about $2 billion for the project. But that 9 cents is the tariff increase for 100% of the gas moving down the pipe. The state's portion of that is 1/8, which would presume that it's a 1.1 cent cost to the state in an overall in the state's share, because the state has a 1/8.
Not exactly. I mean, what it is the state owns 1/8 of the gas.
Okay, so the
and
state
so our gas would go up by 9 cents. Have the same 9 cents. Yeah.
And so I'd be interested then. I appreciate that. It's been a long day. So then I'd appreciate seeing how that 9 cents in an increased tariff cost is juxtaposed against the return that would be enjoyed by those state agencies that are trying to dig out of deep holes. Because even with the pension obligation bond that we're Representative Hawker is considering, if that, you know better, Commissioner, because you're the revenue guy, but if we had a POB at 5.7% interest and we had a regulated return on $1 billion at 12 or 14% interest, the debt coverage would be pretty extraordinary on a significant portion of that pension obligation bond that we were trying to cover. My interest continues to be seeing different methodologies in which the state can participate in the wealth that the hard pipe throws off without compromising the state's position as a sovereign, which was the problem with the state being an LLC and then being a member of another LLC. State of Alaska surrendered its rights any time you turned left or you turned right. But I think, at least my perception of the ARM board and the permanent fund division is that they, and the RCA for that matter, that there are different institutions in the state of Alaska that are very much independent of the state of Alaska government until they get into trouble, until the RCA needs a new sunset, until the ARM board or the PERS-TERS is, you know, completely buried underwater. But were it fully funded, there would be a ring fence around it that none of us, and rightfully so, could touch. And so I'm interested in, I am totally focused on state participation over and above the 70-30 formula, and I'm very much interested in constituent groups within the state having an opportunity to participate, meaning Arctic Slope Regional, CERI, some of the large native group consortiums, which are likely the only ones, like those of us that can participate in hedge funds, that can afford that kind of risk, that kind of a timeline. I'm just saying this for a broader audience than you, obviously, Commissioner, but when I was speaking to Mayor Wirtz about Kibata, about the Kinnick Arm Bridge, and he was talking about that they don't even anticipate that it would have enough tolls on a daily basis until the year 2030. And so I said, hey, I'd like to get a little piece of that Kinnick Arm Bridge, Mr. Mayor. And he said, well, you're going to have to live to be about 110 to enjoy it, because it's amortized so far out that there's debt service for the first 25 years that's kind of rolled into it until there's enough people living there to use the bridge. And so I recognize that that it's quite a restricted group of a constituents. There's a very narrow constituent class that could participate in the 70-30 equity stake. But I'd like to see what we can do, Representative Dahlstrom, when we go into the subcommittee, establish the criteria to involve, you know, presumably the native corporations, which are the only private sector constituent group I can think of that would be large enough to do that without disturbing the 70-30 formula that the administration wants. And then over and above that, I'm interested in seeing what Department of Revenue can do with or without your consent, I'd rather have your help in drafting the amendment, and then if members of revenue want to speak against it or DNR, then I, you know, would respect, you know, the process in that regard. But I'd like your help in drafting an amendment that would offer the words "may" in the language of AGIA for First HERS, for the ARM board, for the permanent fund division, because the permanent fund division would be a way for all Alaskans to participate in a passive sense in AGIA. And I'd like to see the worksheet that in conjunction with that to see what happens when we have a 9-cent tariff increase or a 13-cent tariff increase, you know, billion here, billion here, billion here. What the cost is to the state of Alaska to take over a finite period, I think 30 years was the life that we had in here, what that cost is to the state versus what the benefit would be with the regulated return. I think 14% was in here, but I'd like to see it at 12% and at 14%, depending on what the FERC ruling is for the regulated tariff return, to see what the benefit would be for those state entities, because it may very well be that as a new revenue stream for the state of Alaska, it can absorb 9 cents or 13 cents less because of an increased tariff, whereas the benefit for PERS, TERS, for the ARM board, for the ORP, I think that's the university's retirement group, that over time that $1 billion could work so hard that it could really help lift those cost efficiencies out of the muck, even if we go in the interim and put a pension obligation bond in place to kind of put a tourniquet around the state spending. So I'd be interested in having your assistance in those steps, and then Representative Dahlstrom, as we go into the subcommittee, I'd be equally interested in seeing how we can modify the criteria based very loosely on what Senator Ted Stevens did with the 8A set-asides, where Native groups enjoy a bid preference. I'm interested in what we can do so that the subjective criteria recognize a constituent group of Alaskans that are part of the 30% equity. And then further, I'm also interested in disclosing alignment so that the potential licensees that come before that put applications in, and that you, the two of you, and then the governor presumably review, because I don't think we're going to be able to suck all the subjectivity out of the criteria that we're going to offer into AGIA, but I want to see a disclosure of alignment so that it doesn't say BP Doyon, but Doyon has a 2% interest, whereas it could be TransCanada, MidAmerica, ASRC, and ASRC actually has 20% of the equity, so that an entity like Doyon is window dressing, whereas ASRC is, you know, has an equity stake that's significant. And so I don't know whether that's something that you would prefer some of those things to be drafted by Ledge Legal, or whether it's easier to work with your department. Those, right now, that's the universe of things that I'm interested in. I'm in great support of this piece of legislation, subject to the amendments that this committee and the ensuing you know, very capable resource committee chaired by Representative Gatto and Johnson. But I'm interested in those specific items and sharing, because so much wealth. I mean, that's all we argued about. We never argued about the $1 trillion worth of hydrocarbons last year. We argued about the wealth that was that the pipe threw off, and it's in the billions, billions, and billions, and billions. And Alaskans should share in that tariff piece. I'm very interested in various constituent groups.
And we'll be happy to provide you information both on what would happen if we changed the debt to equity requirement in order to provide for additional investment from a quasi-state agency. Also, we'll try to provide that in the context of what the benefit could be to those entities in terms of this as an investment opportunity, as a new member of both the ARM board and Permanent Fund Corporation. Trustees, infrastructure investment is something that is being looked at as a part of a diversified portfolio, and an investment in this line would need to be looked at in relation to what the other opportunities are and whether this provides a marginal increase in the other opportunities. I think our I'll leave it there and say a lot of other things.
A quick follow-up, Mr. Chairman, just because, you know, time's going to move quickly through House Oil and Gas, and I want to make sure that I'm very specific in what I'm asking for. The other thing that I'm interested in, which is something that we dealt with the LLC and the potential state investment in the Murkowski plan, was if it's a $6 billion investment on a $20 billion pipe, you know, 30% equity, and then we see the pipe go up to $30 billion, then does it diminish the state's stake in that broader project? I need to see a worksheet on that also, so I would request seeing a stylized worksheet that would show what happens if there, you know, it's a $10 billion cost overrun and the ARM board and PERS, TERS, and the permanent fund division are each in for, say, $1 billion. And then we see a cost overrun. And I only need to see a couple scenarios because it'll be enough to give the members, you know, a sense of what's going on. If there's a $5 billion cost overrun, a $20 billion project, and $10 billion cost, how that affects not only the tariff but also the state's return, because it would have a diminished equity stake in the project if it wasn't required, as was the problem last year, to continue to put money in order to maintain its representative share. If it's, say, 4%, you got to keep pouring more money in order to maintain 4%. We would probably just hold the investment at $1 billion and see it reduced from 4% to, say, 3.2% equity stake. And so if you could generate that as an ancillary document, that would be helpful. Mr. Chairman, thank you for letting me take so much time to pose those.
You're quite welcome. Thank you for those very good questions. We look forward to that information, those three items that the representative requested.
Yes, Rip? We have them written down.
Or on tape, even.
You have your homework assignment delegated, so we look forward to it. Rip, before I go to Representative Chambers, did you have a brief remark?
Mr. Chair, I wanted to go back since I'm sitting here now, if I'm allowed.
I got a follow-up on his, okay. Actually.
And then I wanted to come back to a question you had, if it's allowed.
Absolutely, Representative. Happy to accommodate you. Representative Samuels?
A follow-up on Representative Ramos's idea of having two, to me, they're two separate questions. The private sector investment, rather than an additional 30, as part of the 30, as part of the criteria. If you're willing to cut in Alaskan companies, the native corporations, if ASRC wants a piece of it without going to the 35, just as part of the criteria. And secondly, I'm glad he asked the second part of what's the risk also, not just, it's not all, you know, sunshine and roses out there. If you get halfway through the project and the ARM board has lost its shirt, they're not paying for it, we're paying for it. So I'd like to see those, but I like the idea of the criteria for the Alaska companies. Thanks.
Commissioner Irwin?
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Representative Samuels asked a question that I just didn't want to interrupt, and I didn't know if it was legal for me to go back. But he asked the question on competitiveness. Where does it start, or how long can you run a parallel channel? With lots of experience that the U.S. and the world has, federally and certainly statewide with requests for proposals or building a large project, you want the competition, and it really was a good question. Where you run into a problem if you carry it on too far, you start making commitments to go this route or that route, and people start having to make purchasing commitments or environmental commitments, and then you're consuming the energies of two parties plus the state's people. And that gets to be really time consuming when you really want a fair competition. So the reason you draw it off is I'm used to calling it a request for a proposal. But that's a good finish date where then everybody you've decided on who's the winner, who's going to go forward. And then when you make an environmental commitment, you're not duplicating efforts and maybe different efforts. So I hope that adds to it.
Follow-up, Representative Samuels.
Thank you. And I didn't have an answer to my question. It just, and I realize if you triple the work, especially if you're matching the money, now you're tripling the money. But before it starts, your consortium of companies that you're hoping to drive together here, your three different entities or consortiums moving forward, you have no idea if you're picking the worst one on day one. We'll all do the best we can with the criteria and the legislature blessing it, and you guys will pick it. And I understand everybody does the best they can with picking it, but there's really no way to tell. There'd be a really good way to tell 2.5 years from now, right before that open season. You'll go, oh. And if you had them both in your hand, I don't see a way that you can do it. But I have no illusions that the longer you wait, it's the race for the gas. I don't think anybody cares who owns that pipeline, as long as you follow what we want. We want rolled in tariffs and we want all of these other things. But, I'll keep thinking of it. I wake at night thinking of ways to try to get further down the road so that you have that's the true competition, and you race for the gas. And whoever builds a better mousetrap wins. Right now, you don't know who builds a better mousetrap because you're deciding before the mousetrap factory is built.
Over to Samuel, through the chair. I think that those are very valid questions to ask when you have potential, like the pipeline companies here before you, asking them where...
They're all watching. They'll get them.
Well, they understand, and I think that's something that they will need to provide for you in terms of the level to which they're willing to invest their money in that initial race with the understanding that they may be beaten out for the ultimate goal before they even really get further down the line. And I guess the only other point I'd like to make is I disagree slightly with your characterization that we have no idea whether or not we're choosing the best or the worst project when we have that initial run. The truth is that we're trying to design this so that we have a fairly good idea based upon what they provide for us. But what I would agree with is that we can't guarantee that ultimately will prove out to be the best one. But I wouldn't say that we have no idea.
Yeah. So you get Exxon and Enbridge and Conoco and MidAmerica and BP and TransCanada. So you each get a pipeline company with experience. You each get a producer. Every proposal has gas to it. Every proposal has experience to it. The cost of steel is the same for all of them. The cost of capital is the same for all of them. And once again, we get back to the criteria. You get these three entities together, and the pipeline's going to go the same route. The cost of a truck driver is the same for all three entities. The cost of the pipe is roughly the same. Maybe Exxon gets a little better cost of capital just because of their size. Maybe not. Maybe the loan guarantee's playing. Maybe not. Nobody can answer any of those questions on day one. So when it comes to it, here's my three little consortiums here, and you guys are going to be stuck picking between these three entities in there. And TransCanada is going to say they've got the permits in Canada, and Enbridge is going to say no, they don't. And you can see the scenarios, and you're going to pick one, or we're collectively going to pick one. And nothing's going to change between now and the time you pick, with the price of steel being the same for all of them, the price of labor being the same for all of them. So I sympathize with your decision that you're going to have to make. And I have not found a better way to extend the competition, the race for the gas. I have not found a better way either, so I'm not throwing rocks at it, but I'm just wondering internally if you had discussed how to get further down the road without making the choice.
Representative Samuels, through the chair, I guess just in light of your scenario with these three, if we have these three consortiums that all basically look similar, I would say that would be a very wonderful
choice
to make.
Good problem, man.
Because if we end up with three producers and three different pipeline companies all coming and saying that we're committed, we'll do the open season, we'll meet all your terms, and then all we have to do is choose between them, that would be a great scenario for us to find ourselves in from where we are today. But I go back to the answer that I gave earlier. I don't see that happening given where we are today. I think that what we're trying to do is create an opportunity for somebody other than the producers to say, hey, we're willing to take a chance on this project, and we're willing to invest our money to move this project forward. And we need to put up something that gets them to that starting line. And that's really what AGIA is intended to do, is to provide enough that we get somebody willing to come to the starting line and start it off. If we had a sense that we could get two, three other companies willing to come to the starting line and begin that race, and we could draw a line in the sand somewhere out in the future and say, whoever's the first one to get to this point gets the big prize at the end, then that would be a more ideal and probably a more likely successful outcome. But the information that we've received thus far is that we're not going to get those folks willing to begin to throw money, you know, tens of millions of dollars into this to get that part going.
I understand the point.
Representative Dugan?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This may be actually be something that's more appropriately discussed in the subcommittee, but and I may be all wet about this, but I think what we've got here is a procedure in which you're going to select a licensee according to a relatively extensive, if as yet sort of unweighted, set of criteria. But then if somebody wants to buy into this license or buy this license, all that's really required is that the commissioners find that the transfer does not increase or diminish the obligations created by the license or diminish the value of the license to the state, which is a much sort of simpler set of selection criteria. And I haven't thought this through, so I don't even know where I am on this, but the committee, or at least the subcommittee, might want to think about whether we don't want to apply some of the criteria by which you get selected to be the licensee to the situations in which you get to get a big piece or even a majority holding in the license.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would ask that the subcommittee led by Representative Dahlstrom, who chaired that, please consider that issue, including ways that we can simplify the criteria as much as possible. Thank you very much for that observation. Any other questions you need? One thing that I had brought up yesterday, I guess it was, having to do with the coordinator position. I don't mean to be harping on a relatively small issue, because that's certainly smaller than issues such as the $500 million and the tax breaks and other things here. But that is an issue that will be given some attention by this committee, and that is the duration of this. It just seems to me the wording of this thing is a little bit loose, in that the person could end up having that position conceivably for 10, 12, 15 years. Do you have any opinion on that as to whether we should tighten that up a little bit? And to add to that is the issue of what would be the anticipated, for lack of a better word, bureaucracy that would stem from this position that would be created, because certainly this person's going to have to hire assistants and so forth. We certainly would like to see that in a conservative way, but we want to make sure you have the resources to do the job as well. So can you answer those two points, please?
Sure. On the first point, with regard to the length of time, the position is what's designated within the statute as being in place for that duration. The person who would serve in that position would serve at the pleasure of the governor. And so that would not necessarily be the same person throughout that whole time. It would be a matter of likely there'd be a change in governors, and so they'd have to survive that transition. With regard to the second part, in terms of the positions that may also spring out of that, the fiscal note that you have, I think it's the Department of Natural Resources fiscal note, recognizes four positions that would be associated with the office. We anticipate the office, that's, I think, at this point in time, what we would consider to be the fully staffed office, and not going beyond that, because the position is not intended to be a make-work kind of, they don't have an authorization that they have to work on. They're coordinating among the other agencies. And so the other agencies would have to be adequately staffed, and that was part of an earlier discussion. But our vision for that coordinator role is a lean office.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you. Representative Dahlstrom?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I shared a different view of that than you did, but it's been clarified, and so I appreciate that. Thank you.
Anything else? It doesn't appear that we have any more questions at this point. So what I'll do is conclude the meeting. Before I do so, just to reiterate a couple of things, our schedule is includes a public hearing with the Senate Resources Committee. We are coordinating with them as much as we can in this process. We are going to have this general public hearing tomorrow at 5:30 in the, I believe it's the Butrovich Room. Did I say that right, Jim? And did you want to hear from Mr. Bullock today? Okay, well, I've been surprised that Mr. Bullock is here from Ledge Legal, so I guess we won't conclude after all, but anybody that needs to go to a subsequent meeting is certainly welcome to go. But let me just finish with what I was saying before we go to Mr. Bullock, and that is to just reiterate our joint meeting tomorrow. I've been told that at 3:30, Senate Resources is going to have presentations, albeit briefly, by, let me get my glasses on here, Chevron, BP, and GB. For those that aren't familiar with GB, BG, excuse me, that's a British gas. That's, I don't know frankly anything about the company. I have an appointment with a gentleman in my office this afternoon, but I understand it's just a mid-sized company from Europe. I assume that would be from Britain, but I don't know anything beyond that, quite frankly. That'll be, I have an appointment with a representative from that company in my office today just to get acquainted with the company, and then that company is going to present to Senate Resources at 3:30 tomorrow, and any oil and gas members are welcome to be a part of that as well. And then following that will be our FERC presentation on Thursday, and then additional oil and gas company testimony on Friday, just to reiterate our schedule for the benefit of the members. And we did send a summary to all members as well as to that schedule. So, Mr. Bullock, thank you very much. And you're here to go over the Ledge Legal's evaluation of this legislation. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Before we start with you, we have a question from Representative Samuels.
Thank you. I just wanted to make one comment. I don't know if BG was testifying today or tomorrow, but BG, on a global scale, is not a small player. They are only 50% of the imports into the United States for LNG are handled by BG. They own some acreage in the foothills, and they partner with Anadarko. So in Alaska, they produce nothing. They're an explorer here. They don't produce anything. But they have a lot of acreage in a future player. But on a global scale, they're a very large player in the gas world, very large.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that. I indicated mid-size. Thanks for that correction. I appreciate it. Ms. Nelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a clarification for me, Mr. Bullock. Are you here at the request of the chair, at the request of the department, at the request of?
At the request of the chair, and I had just forgotten the fact that he was here to offer some insight from his
great
perspective on the legislation. I apologize for that.
Thank you.
And was there anybody else who had their hand up? I guess not. So, excuse me, I almost called you Representative Bullock. Mr. Bullock, perhaps a future representative from Juneau, who knows?
I don't think so. I'll leave the fun to you. My name is Don Bullock. I'm an attorney in legislative legal services, and I will be the drafter in the bill as it goes through the committee and drafting your amendments, and we'll be anxious to probably have you work with the administration as you move forward so that you can mesh your intent with their intent, mm-hmm, and come up with a bill that makes everybody happy, mm-hmm, if that's possible. I've looked at the bill. I provided you earlier with a kind of a sectional summary of the bill, but I've also examined the bill from the standpoint of its basic structure and some issues that you may wish to consider just for clarification purposes.
And for the benefit of the members, excuse me, sir, in your packets, there is a tab there entitled a sectional legislative legal in parentheses, so you might want to turn to that and follow along.
The bill's structured into five different articles, and it might help you to compartmentalize your thoughts among the five articles. The first is Article 1 just states the purpose of the bill. Article 2 relates to the license for the project, requirements for the state, includes the cash incentive up front to share the cost. Article 3 is the inducements to the shippers that commit to pipeline capacity during the first binding open season. Article 4 is miscellaneous provisions, and among which is the establishment of the fund that will hold the matching money until it's dispersed. And then Article 5 is the definition section, the general provisions applicable to the whole bill. I have a few comments as we go from my reading of the bill and things for you to consider. The first one is in Section 4390.110. And this is the section that provides for the state's matching funds of $500 million. What struck me about this matching fund is that it's over two intervals. The first interval is from the time the license is issued to the end of the first binding open season, and the bill's set up to provide a 50% match during that period. We don't know, there's no cap on the amount, we don't know how much would be left, but if there is something left, and presumably there will be, then the state can go up to an 80% match, and that match will be decided on by what the applicant presents with their application as to what kind of a percentage they would expect from the state. But since you have a single licensee that's going to get both, perhaps you may consider having the applicant as part of their license application say how much they're going to spend altogether out of the $500 million. They may have an idea of what it's going to cost to get through the first binding open season, and then how much will be left that they could speculate. But right now it's not allocated. You have a single licensee. You may wish to consider a pitch on both. The Section 110 also refers to a state training program for gas pipeline-related jobs. And I don't know if there's another bill that's going to be forthcoming that relates to this, or whether there's an existing program in effect, but you may want to be more specific as to what kind of program you're referring to, because this is offered as one of the incentives for a project to go forward.
Second, is that done, so I can make a note of that?
And it's in 110.
110, sorry, okay.
It's on page three. One of the inducements is the benefits of a state program that provides training for employment and gas line project, pipeline project management and so forth.
Thank you.
Just structurally, the next section of the bill provides for the abandonment of the project. And structurally, I would just move this section later on when you're talking about violations of the license agreement, and basically this is a what happens if things go south, how you're going to deal with it, and I would put those together at the end. In section 4390.130 has the commissioner shall commence a public process to request applications for a license under this chapter within 3 months of the effective date. This is one of those things that sound great but might create a problem down the road. What happens if it's not done in 3 months? Generally, the way we deal with that is we put a section at the end of the bill and says it's the legislature's intent that the commissioners take this action within 3 months.
Excuse me, Don. Representative, my good friend, Remmers. Hey, don't forget the fact that you're a very good friend, even though I might forget a name every now and then.
That's most important, Chairman. Hi, Mr. Bullock. It's so rare in this building that I've ever heard anybody say something concise when being verbose will do just fine. My friend, Representative Samuels, said in four words the biggest problem that Representative Dahlstrom articulated, and he said, you pick, we bless. And I thought that was genius. I went around.
They didn't.
Yeah. They didn't. And so my friends on the other side of the building, who some treat me well and some have treated me poorly, and some of it has been deserved over the last couple of years, they don't like to give things away unless there's some quid pro quo. And I, on the other hand, am pretty comfortable with the House giving away its right to pick in order to bless the project. I think that's a compelling component and it brings some efficiency to the process. But what I'm interested in and what I'd like to get your feedback on is the concern that Representative Dahlstrom raised. She's the chair of, graciously, of the chairman's subcommittee. Mm-hmm. And that is, tell me about the criteria. How do we take some of the subjectivity out of it? If you pick and we bless, then we sure would like to reserve the right, I think, to tell you how to pick. I think, as that's what we're going to be up to, isn't it? Right, through the chair, mm-hmm. Representative Dahlstrom? Mm-hmm.
We are going to discuss through the chair different possibilities, different scenarios, different structures.
So since that is part of, thank you, Mr. Chairman, sorry.
I just have a cold, I'm not interrupting you, sir.
If that is part of 43.90130, and it says to develop provisions in the application for license and to evaluate applications received. Can you give us your musings and your thoughts right now and report back to us with something drafted, what your immediate thoughts are out of the box so that we can begin to take that work product and start to massage it and work it through better as to what you think ought to be the criteria for an application evaluation?
Well, I don't mean to punt, but it's very policy ridden. For example, one of the criteria would be to maximize the wellhead value, which benefits the state in terms of royalty and the PPT that's based on the wellhead value, the PPT wellhead value with allowable deductions. So is that going to be the criteria? You're going to have to consider, it sounds like there may be two alternative routes, one that'll go down to Valdez and involve marine terminal and maritime transportation against an overland route. Are the cost overruns going to be more significant on a route that's completely overland, or would they be more significant involving a marine terminal and tankers? These are things that are really going to be difficult to gauge. You're not going to have very many common things between the two, except for an ultimate netback from a sales price to that wellhead value and what the effect of each project is. The other thing that you're going to have to consider is the availability of gas for consumers in the state. One of the criteria in here, or one of the requirements, it's not a criteria, are the five offtakes. I'm sure you don't want them in one place. So it may be an advantage to specify one on the Yukon River, one within a certain number of miles of Fairbanks, a certain number of miles of Delta Junction, this type of criteria, you know, so that you're actually getting what you want out of the project. The Commissioner of Revenue testified regarding the criteria that you may put the criteria in the bill. You may get a project applicant that writes their application to the criteria, but it just doesn't feel right. And it's true, it matches the criteria, but it just doesn't rest with that kind of applications in the best interest of the state. So as much as possible, I think you need to consider what the state wants to get out of the pipeline. And I could write you a memo and give you my own opinion as to where the priority should be in consideration of the criteria. But my advice to you is whatever you decide the benefits from this pipeline are expected to be, that you put these into your bill so that the commissioners can take your guidance. It's clear what the policy decision is, and if there's somebody that doesn't get the license and challenges it, that the criteria are defensible and that they've been followed properly.
Excuse me. Mike, did you have a question?
No.
Okay. Thank you. Those are some real good observations, and I actually will probably take you up in your offer, produce a memo and just summarize your recommendations on this legislation.
Okay. And there are three things, three sections of the bill that really relate to the criteria. The first of all is the request for applications of the license, which in addition to the things that the supposed to be in the application under 4390-140, the commissioners right up front can say, we're looking for this, we want this information, speak to this. For example, and also one of those things that would be in the request is the due date. 140 are the specific things that an applicant is required to promise to do. And just for your information, a lot of these they sound very similar to what FERC requires in the notice of open season, these type of promises. So if you want to read more, you can look at that. And then so the applicant gives those commitments in 140. And then 170 are the application evaluation criteria. Also in line with the review of the applications, I'm not sure of the timing of section 180. And this is 180 is the section that requires for public notice and the 60-day period for public review. Now, the way the bill is structured, this notice comes after the evaluation criteria. But I'm not sure whether the intention is that the public be open for the to review the applications after the commissioners have already weeded out those that don't qualify. So all the applications that will be evaluated are going to be open for public comment, or whether the commissioners will apply the criteria in 170, come up with a favored application, and then submit their favored application, potential licensee, to the public. I think that's something that you need to consider, is when you want the public input. Part of that issue that relates to that, and public comment will be important, so that when the legislature is given the potential licensee for review, that it may be that you don't have to reduplicate the whole hearing process. So there may be a way that you feel that you can structure that so it can be handled most efficiently. There's an issue, and I think you discussed it yesterday at the committee, regarding this 30th legislative day and the problem if the application is presented to the legislature with fewer than 30 days left in a regular session, or it's not quite ready on the first day of a special session. As the bill is written, if it was submitted with 20 days left in the regular session, the session wasn't extended, then the next 21st through the 30th legislative day would be the start of the next regular session. And this overlaps another body of law about calling special sessions. I mean, however, the timing is in the hands of the commissioners. They can just take this into effect. But I've tried to think of a different way to deal with this 30-day period, and I haven't been able to come up with a good solution because of the problems of calling a special session.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Looks like Scott was kind of plenty of questions there, but I'll turn it over to Mike.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John, does that mean that if we were to go to a, say the legislature decided it needed 60 days to review this, would that mean that we could only review it in a session that had 60 or more days in it?
Well, you have 30-day limits on your special sessions, and there are other limits on extending the regular session. So, and the legislature, when it calls itself into special session, doesn't have to be limited to a single topic. So there are, you do have discretion into how many special sessions. But a lot of this comes back to how many legislative days does the legislature have to bless the project.
Thank you. Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would it make more sense to say prior to 30th day? I mean, what if the 30th day is pinned here? Whether it's Easter Sunday or whatever day, it could be Christmas.
Right.
Do we want to pin it like that, or do you want to say prior to?
You could put that in, but my understanding from the intent is, even though this project may take 10 to 15 years to pursue, you want to get it done as soon as possible. You want to get the ball in motion. So I'm not saying how you should deal with that, but speed seems to be a factor in this consideration. So that if you put in a requirement to say at least 30 days before the end of a regular session, submit the application. But if it's not ready, you don't want to necessarily have to wait until a special session or the next regular session.
Representative Nelson, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bullock, just help me clarify. You stated if the application wasn't ready. My understanding is once the applications go in, if there is something missing, the commissioners will then have the opportunity to go back to those companies and ask for that additional information, but it's still considered that their application is in. So in my mind, there's no reason that somebody that really seriously wants to do business with the state of Alaska won't have their application in. Am I misinterpreting that?
No, I mean that some applications will be weeded out as non-responsive. Other applications will still be alive, but which may be, and it depends on how the commissioners apply it, it may be that this application has great potential, but we just need a little bit more information. Because at some point, the commissioners are going to say, these are the applications that we have that are complete. And then looking at all the applications that are responsive, they will apply the criteria and then pick the licensee that they're going to present to the legislature. And if the legislature disapproves, then I imagine they'd go back and re-advertise and submit new proposals. But otherwise, if the legislature doesn't disapprove, if the legislature, for example, does nothing, then the license can be issued.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I just wanted to remind the gentleman whose cell phone went off that we do have a donut fund for the Oil and Gas Committee, so please deposit the $20 before you go out the door. Okay? Well, I'll be in charge of it. I get to choose which donuts I want. Representative Dugan?
Now, if I can only remember the question I was going to ask before the prospect of donuts drove all thought from my mind. And you know what? I can't, so I'll pass.
Yeah, I like that answer, or that question. Anybody, Representative Gatto?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Is it possible to say on or about in language like this so as not to be
squishy?
What I'm after. I'm after the elbow room.
Yes, I mean, there are things that you can say to express a preference, and there are things that you can say when you want an exact date or something exactly to happen a certain way.
Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Bullock, I believe the way the bill is drafted now, it gives the legislature 30 days to disapprove the license. Is that a novel way to do these things? Is it constitutionally acceptable in your opinion?
One of the issues that came up in the 2006 project was the issue of executive power versus legislative power. And there were many interpretations that said that contracting and this type of commitment by the state's an executive function. And so in that way, it would be similar to board appointments that are subject to advice and consent by the legislature. Also, since the legislature itself is enacting this law, it is kind of consenting to the fact that the executive is taking the lead, but the legislature is reserving the right to review it and say, I don't think so. Section 4390210, which is on page 11, it's a requirement that it says that a licensee that's awarded a certificate of public convenience and necessity for the project shall accept a certificate issued by FERC if the project is engaged in interstate commerce or Regulatory Commission of Alaska. It may be that it's subject to both, and the Department of Law tariff experts may provide you greater advice in this area. I'm not a tariff expert. But you're going to have an in-state portion of the line that's from the North Slope to the outtake point, and you're going to have an interstate segment that may go into Canada and connect farther down south. So where it talks about language like that, it may be that both FERC and RCI are involved. The qualifications, moving ahead to the this gas pipeline coordinator issue. This section, at the beginning, I said that there are five articles in this bill, and they're kind of divided where the second article relates to the project and the licensing, and the third article has to do with inducements for shippers. And whether this Gas Line Inducement Act coordinator just should physically be moved because it's primarily to help the project going forward into Article 2. That's just a structural issue. But there are issues related to this position itself. I mean, there's been a recent issue of a government appointment and whether that person should be unappointed or asked to step down. And this may be an appropriate time to deal with an issue like that up front, mm-hmm. The proper removal of this position. You also may wish to consider minimum requirements for this person that they must meet, similar to the expertise that you hire on the Regulatory Commission of Alaska or the OGCC, because this person is going to be looking at the laws that are applied by agencies, determining whether they're impeding the project and whether they're being misinterpreted or not, so that this position itself will have to have some expertise. You also may wish to designate that this person can hire additional experts, much like you're allowing the commissioners in this process to hire experts and to enter into contracts with those firms. It sounds like it's, the position will be under the, directly under the governor and the governor's office, and I think the bill should be amended to reflect that, that position.
Okay.
Back up to the royalty inducement, I'm not sure exactly how this works. And, but what I can imagine is that if a producer that's producing on the North Slope is going to make this commitment to a certain amount of capacity during the first mining open season, they're going to have their 7/8 of their own oil, and they're going to have access to the state's royalty oil. And I believe Mr. Banks testified that the state has historically has not taken its oil in kind. So it's probably a pretty safe bet that a producer should be able to commit at some or all of the royalty into that, that open, during that open season, that capacity. But I, my expectation is that of this position, of this particular provision is that they don't want to commit oil or gas that they won't be able to put into the line, and they'll basically be penalized for not being able to take advantage of what they committed to. So I'm not sure exactly how this works, but I think the purpose is to give them some security as to how much gas they'll have to put in the line. Moving on to the production tax exemption. In the 2006 proposal, there was an issue that had to do with locking in the tax rates in a contract. And when the state has actually entered into a contract, it raises the issue under Article 1, Section 15 of the state constitution as to whether the legislature, if they change the tax law that was contrary to the contract provision, whether that tax law would be prohibited because it impairs the obligation of a contract. This bill does not lock in a rate of the contract, but it provides a remedy through an exemption if the tax rates increase. Now, as a drafter, I have some issues with calling the way this is structured an exemption, because really it amounts as a tax credit. It says that if the taxes increase, then they're going to receive a credit or reduction in the tax that's equal to the amount of the tax increase. Mm-hmm. There's another way to do it that may make it more clearly an exemption, and that is that if the tax were to, say, go up 4%, that you could exclude or effectively exempt 4% of their production that's committed into the portion of the pipeline that they acquired during open season. And the reason I suggest that type of approach, where you're actually exempting part of the commodity, is that it's more in line with the examples of exemptions in Article 9, Section 4. And it says, you know, like the property exemptions, churches don't get a credit equal to the tax. They're just not subject to tax in the first place. And I think that framing the exemption that way may make it more bulletproof on a challenge as to whether this is an exemption. This is a general law. This provision is subject to future amendment. The legislature does have flexibility to revisit the issue. And historically, in 1973, the legislature, when the state was quite short of money, had a special session in which they looked at the oil and gas laws, because at that time TAPS had been delayed and the state had to reconsider its tax policy just to tie it over. And that's one of the reasons why the state has to maintain a certain amount of flexibility. Any questions?
I don't see any yet. Do you have one, Jerry?
Getting close.
Can we get back to you momentarily? Go ahead, Don.
Representative Dugan mentioned the issues about the special fund that holds the matching funds. Normally, when we create funds like this as a drafting matter, we'll say that this does not create a dedicated fund. It's just extra language to make it really clear. But there are other cases where we do create a fund in the general fund. Money's appropriated into it, and it doesn't lapse. And that recently, there's a fund that was created for veteran cemeteries in the state. And the money's there, and the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs can use that money for cemetery purposes without further appropriation. And the theory, the reason is that that money was appropriated for that purpose when it went into that fund.
Doing good, Don. Are you ready?
We don't have anything substantive to speak to further. I mean, there's a one word in the definitions, controlling isn't used and doesn't need to be defined, but there are minor things like that. But I think I've shared with you the high points of the things that I've noticed since I've gone.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bullock. Appreciate that. And if you'd please give us not just a summary, but a list of your comments and memo as you talked about, so that we can have those before us for consideration later on. That would be much appreciated. Representative Ramirez.
Thank you. One of the questions that Representative Samuels asked previously, and yes, great question. What are the remedies that, and pardon me if this was asked when I was at the restroom, Mr. Chairman, but what are the remedies that the state would have if there is a qualified applicant and we get to the open season and the producers don't show up? What are the remedies that the state would have short of litigation? Because I don't wish to litigate. Has that question been asked?
No, it has not.
I expect it would come under the abandonment issue, because the project would be, yeah. I mean, the purpose of the open season, to back up with, is to show that there's a need for the pipeline, that there are people that are committed to it. And if you don't have the people committed to it, then it's not going to be an economic project to go forward. You would only be going forward on speculation. And so under the bill, you'd be in an abandonment situation.
Let me be more specific, I guess. Short of litigating the industry or raising their taxes to a merciless rate.
Option B.
You mean the world average?
Spoken by somebody who wasn't here last year. I'm sorry.
Mr. Hurley, Mr. Canal, Ms. King, Mr. Calder, I asked that question. Short of litigation, short of rattling a stick, you know, to raise oil taxes, what are the remedies that are going to be available to the state? The nature of this is the Alaska Gas Line Inducement Act. And if it's a trail of breadcrumbs that leads the state to a contract through a process, it seems to me that the trail of crumbs stop when we get to the open season, and that there's a giant question mark there that, in fact, there isn't an inducement to get the producers to produce the gas. And I'm looking for that in this legislation, and I don't see it. From your point of view, what is the inducement element in this drafted document? Other than just to monetize, I mean, clearly it's to monetize the gas, but if there's a problem at open season, it's because, you know, the cost of the pipe is too much. What is the inducement component around the open season piece? And I'll, you know, throw that question to the back of the room also to the Commissioner of Natural Resources, and Commissioner Gellman's gone. But Doctor, you might have a position on that also. What's the inducement, in your point of view, around that piece, around the performance during the open season?
Well, I think it goes beyond that, actually, and it's what we're going to see as a result of the Point Thompson litigation, where producers have had their production terms and leases, and as to whether they're going to honor the terms or not, or whether the leases should be withdrawn, as some of them were in Point Thompson, or the unit was dissolved. I mean, this bill provides two incentives for shippers to come and commit. One is the change in the royalty regulations, and the second is the tax break. But if that's not enough of a carrot, then maybe the...
Mr. Chairman, there's a big difference between the definition, I don't have my Black's Law Dictionary, but there's a big difference between the word incentive and inducement. And this whole thing is the Alaska Gas Line Inducement Act, and I'm not interested in incentives. I'm interested in inducement around the part of this that is certainly has raised just about the most questions in this process, which is, how are you going to get the producers to produce the gas, get it ready, get it to monetize the gas once you've spent $1 billion? So I guess that's what got me, Mr. Chairman, is so much of this document is about spending $1 billion and lays out this very tight timeline to get right to the open season. And Commissioner, I'm so happy you came in.
But it's not unlike trying to get your neighbor to sell you his car. I mean, what's it going to take for him to get to sell it to you?
Oh, it's quite unlike it, Mr. Bullock, with all due respect. it's quite unlike that. I mean, because the state's going broke. The state has $1 trillion worth of gas that it needs to monetize. So it's quite unlike that. And I framed this with some light remarks, but I'm really, really very serious about this, and I am casting a broader net with this question. You just happen to be sitting in the chair to the Commissioner of Revenue and the Commissioner of Natural Resources, which is the Alaska Gas Line Inducement Act. Love it. Great, great piece of legislation. And I see the breadcrumbs. They go right through the whole 3-year, 4-year, 5-year process, right to the open season. Where's the inducement there? How do we know that we're going to consummate a deal once we get to the open season? Show me the inducement to make the producers want to monetize their hydrocarbon molecules. And I don't think that's a question for you. I think it just shot way over your head, Mr. Bullock. But
no,
unless you can point to section 4.3 dot something.
If you look historically, as soon as the Prudhoe Bay leases in 1969 were sold, they were ordering pipe right away. And with the known gas reserves, there hasn't been a movement in that way. I mean, what are the elements of that decision, and how can we affect that decision making? That's the secret. And when the producers come and speak to you, that's a good question to ask.
Mr. Chairman, while we have the Commissioner of Revenue and Natural Resources here, I'd like to ask them that question also as soon as the committee is done with Mr. Bullock, if you don't mind. I'm not trying to usurp, but I'd like to ask that question while they're here.
Please do that.
Are there any other questions?
We do have three more. Excuse me, Ralph. We've got that. Dahlstrom has been waiting patiently. Thank you, Nancy, followed by Santos and Dugan. So, Nancy?
Okay. Well, thank you. Mine's just kind of a follow-up, and the commissioners can respond, or it's just a statement. First of all, Mr. Bullock, I'm going to come back to you later with questions about the gas production tax exemption section, because my understanding of what is in the bill and what I heard from you isn't the same thing. So I need to study that some more, and then I'm going to come to you and several other people and talk about that. I'm hearing some different things, and I'm going to need clarification on that. And then to my good friend from Fairbanks, Representative Ramirez, maybe I'm naive, but I just can't fathom from any of my discussions with the producers, with the pipe companies, that we're going to get to that point and they're going to walk away from it. I can't fathom it. And when I read back on the history of what happened in this state, with the in the early pipeline days, and what happened there, and how what happened in our state made history worldwide. Yes, we have some rocky road to get over, but and I have a lot of concerns and things we need to work out. But I don't know any other word to say that. I just can't imagine that would be the case. So, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Samuels?
Thanks. I wanted to clarify. You made a point. You compared the lawsuit at Point Thompson, and I, for one, agreed with what Menge and Rutherford both did there. But the lawsuit at Point Thompson is different because the next lawsuit isn't at Point Thompson. The next lawsuit is to take Prudhoe Bay away, and it has produced $250 billion of revenue for the feds, the producers, and the state, and it's a current operating oil field with however many tens of billions of dollars in infrastructure. Taking Point Thompson away, that's one thing. Taking Prudhoe Bay away, that is an entirely different issue. And the litigation, if you end up not at the, it's the 6 years to the second open season, and I will ask this question over and over and over again. Don't show up at the first open season. I mean, the bill has contingency plans planning on that, that it's a failed open season. So you go through to the second open season, and what are the plans with a second failed open season? And I can fathom it. And that, it, if I'm a shareholder at ExxonMobil and I make 30% every single year and my management tells me it's a worse deal to go to this and bid my gas, or I'll wait for whatever the reason is, and maybe Congress starts beating on them and they get a better deal, or the state raises it, you start jacking up PPT, 1% a year. How about 5? How about 5% a year until you come to an open season? We got leverage, but what's going to happen to an investment? I mean, what's going to happen? And when you get to the second failed open season, if you're a shareholder for ExxonMobil and you've made 30% a year, year after year after year, and your management tells you, I can get a better deal next year, who are you going to believe? So I can't see it. I understand the point. You can't just roll over. But Point Thompson and Prudhoe Bay are different stories. Different stories to try to take Prudhoe Bay and Kuparuk away.
Through the chair, I didn't mean to say that was an automatic conclusion as to what's going to happen. The leases are a matter of contract between the state and the leaseholders. And if there are good reasons for changing the production requirements, the leases could be renegotiated.
Excellent observations, Representative Samuels. I appreciate that. Representative Dugan?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure if this is the appropriate time or not, but if the commissioner can come back up to address Representative Ramirez's question here. I just wanted to associate myself with his comments. I'm committed to working as hard as I can to make this bill the best bill that I can possibly make it. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure everybody else here and all the way along the way is too.
Absolutely.
But frankly, I don't see a cause-effect relationship between this bill and a gas pipeline, because we do end up with a big question mark, which is there going to be enough gas committed at the open season for the pipeline to be financed?
Yeah, good point.
And,
see what you caused?
You know, there's really, no matter how good a job we do here, there's really nothing in this bill that guarantees that we're going to get that gas committed. Mm-hmm. You know, and in the absence of that, one of my big fears is, we pass this bill, we tell everybody, great, the pipeline's coming. We get to the open season, and you know what? The pipeline isn't coming. Mm-hmm. You know, so I agree with my friend from Fairbanks here. It is a big question mark. And I was here through oil development, and I know that there were many times in which the state and the producers did not agree, that there were differences of opinion, there were lawsuits, there were all kinds of things that went on. And so I don't think it is guaranteed that the producers are going to be in the position when they get to the open season where they absolutely have to commit to gas. I'm having said all that, I'm not sure what you do about that.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying, it's a big worry of mine that we do this and basically in 3 years, nothing happens.
Right. Yeah, excellent point.
Care
to take a stab at that one?
Mr. Chair, to several of the members of the committee, a couple thoughts really come to mind. First off, I shared the thought, and I'll use this as a primer. I worked for a man who had a sign on his desk and said there's three types of people. those who hope something happen, those who watch something happen, and those who make things happen. Well, we can sit around 1, 2, 5 years, however many we wish, and hope something happens. That's not acceptable. We can watch what's happened, and by the history we've seen so far, the state's held hostage. That's not acceptable. So we're making something happen. And I guess in summary, what I would say is, I'll take the producers at their word. They're worried about risk. That's what we're doing. We're addressing risk to open season. We're, maybe they won't participate. Maybe they will choose, and I can't speak for them. They're very capable companies to speak for themselves. They might choose not to play an open season. Once there's a certified process or a project on the board, I think they will have some interesting decisions internally in their own companies. They know the risk. They've clearly said they manage the transportation risk. That's their business. So we'll take them at their word they do that. So this board, I would find it an interesting discussion. We know the risk. We need to book our reserves. We need to monetize our gas. Are we going to keep recycling gas forever? Will Prudhoe Bay take that recycling? I think there will be some interesting scenarios at that time. Now, one of the things I think you're all excluding, they might say they're not going to participate, but when there's real risk of others participating, and they're good business people, you know, again, I can't speak for them, but they're good at this. They just might want to be part of the program. So it's a legitimate question. It's a legitimate worry. It's a much bigger worry to sit and do nothing and hope something happens. So I believe is them and is incredibly good business people. Yes, they can go worldwide. They make decisions worldwide. This is a tremendously huge resource connected to a good market also. And I think they and their boards make good decisions.
Before we get to Representative Gano, but did you want to make a comment or add
a
follow-up question here?
Yes, sir. And I have great respect for both of you. And is the Alaska Gas Line Inducement Act, and clearly you've induced a process. Commissioner, you're one of the people I respect most in the whole world. And I trust the producers also. Trust but verify. Words like might, words like want, that's the difference in this building between shall and may. And we're very careful when we employ those two words. And might and want don't have the, we're going to be signing a check for $500 million and a commitment of a specificity of time, several years. Two open seasons would be six, one open season would be four, I think.
Three.
Three?
3, 6, and 11, magic numbers.
And so what is the inducement component that we can introduce to your piece of legislation that surrounds the open season piece? Because to me, there's two inducements, in fact. There's the Alaska Gas Line Inducement Act that talks about creating a process. Second one that I'm just kind of puzzling through is, what is the inducement at the critical period of time, which is to induce a connection between the licensee, which is really what this bill addresses, is inducing a licensee to participate to connect the male and the female, and the other piece is the at the open season. And where's the inducement there at the moment of consent?
Follow on that one.
Mr. Chair, could Representative Ramirez ask the question in a different form?
I don't think we want to follow that metaphor any further.
Looking at through the chair, Representative Ramirez, from a strictly business standpoint.
Yeah.
We can't anticipate at this point where we're going to be with regard to the project that we have at the time that we've got a FERC certificate in hand and we have an open season. At that particular point in time, what the economics of the choice that the producers are being asked to make. We can't anticipate today what the dynamics are going to be at that particular point. What we recognize is that right now, we have different options in terms of how to pursue the state's interest. We have spent a great deal of time just pursuing directly what's it going to take to get the producers to commit full bore to this project, that both building it and committing their gas to it. That's what you guys spent a lot of time talking about that a year ago. And what we identified through that process was not only would it take more than what the state was willing to put in, but in the end, we didn't really get much as far as a commitment. So we look at, well, why was that? Well, a big part of it was because there's so much uncertainty with this project right now. We don't know what the project, ultimately, where it's going to go, how much it's going to cost, how you're going to get your permits. All those things are still unknown. And so to some extent, the cost of the state trying to overcome that in the minds of the producers was overwhelming. We just couldn't get there right now. The intent of AGEA is to move through those uncertainties, to get a project, the best one that we can identify at this particular point in time, to move through those uncertainties and eliminate them as much as we can between now and initially the open season. At that particular juncture, we're going to be a ways through. We're not going to be all the way through. We're going to have a certain understanding about the project. A certain amount will be expended to clarify some of the uncertainties that we have right now. And we recognize that at that juncture, it would be a great juncture for the state to be able to say, this project's on its own. You've got everything that you need. You're moving. And we've got you to where we needed to get you. And that's why we're putting a lot on that initial open season. We're putting the upstream inducements that we will go into great detail with. What if that doesn't happen? What if that isn't good enough? What if we still have too much uncertainty at that point, that the amount that we need to overcome is still too great for the producers to participate? We keep moving forward. Again, what we have to recognize is that by getting from the open season to FERC certificate, we will move through a tremendous amount of the risk of this project, the cost overrun risk. Most of the cost overrun risk is going to be identified and be basically born during that period of time. We will know at the end of that what a fairly close estimate of what the ultimate cost is going to be. And at that particular point in time, we will all have a better idea of the economics of the project, the gap between the 30% rate of return that Exxon expects to get on a project and what they can expect to get from this particular project. We'll know how much additional value really needs to be put on the table in order to actually get them to that point. Right now, we don't have that. And then we'll have an opportunity to identify how that can be filled, whether it's through something the state needs to do, something the feds need to do, something that the producers need to just accept. But trying to anticipate today what it's going to take to overcome that at that particular time is what I would consider to be unnecessary. What we need to do is we need to get to that point in time, because we'll be better off at that point in time than we are today. And that's at this juncture, given the options that are before us, that's the best thing for the state right now, is to get to that point.
Follow-up, Representative Ramos, then we'll go to Carl.
And I'll be brief, because I see the clock, Mr. Chairman. But your point's well taken, Commissioner, but the legislative process, and we just came from a couple of grueling hours of it on this ethics bill, which is another high priority of your governor, and the legislative process is to take something that's as best as we can make it right now and anticipate what we need to do next. And so here I see with this bill, we're going to spend $500 million, and I'm in favor of that, and I'm going to sign my name off of that, to induce a process to get to the open season, and there's no shall waiting at the open season. There's a may. And I'm not satisfied with the second leg of that journey. I'm delighted with the first leg, and I agree with you. There are things that can't be anticipated, but I don't hear an inducement piece to create a shall environment, that they shall participate in an open season. I keep hearing they may participate in an open season, and I hear from my friend that they may not. And I think that whether it's this committee or whether it's the next committee referral in the House, that we should be addressing the shall portion on the second leg of this journey, and that is the mission of the legislature. Maybe not the mission of the governor's bill, but that is the duty of this legislature. If we're going to sign a check for $500 million to get to, there may be an open season, we should be spending $500 million to get to, there shall be a qualified open season.
Representative Ramos, through the chair, need to be careful of that direction. Because what you're doing is starting to negotiate with yourself as a state again. That is a slippery slope. So as a caution,
sure,
we can't be held hostage to a single system that says we will do it when we want and tell you ante up the price. Now, we need maybe, but our business world can negotiate out of you. So once you start saying, what do we give at that point, when there will be significant issues at that time, uncertainties, some of the uncertainties gone, time's gone by, how much gas has to then be recycled at Prudhoe Bay, those kind of things, the state can't allow itself to get into a negotiation of endless numbers.
Point taken, but we shall raise the taxes. If I mean that can be the language in this bill, is we shall raise the PPT if producers fail to show up for the open season. I mean, there are other inducements. I'm just suggesting that there isn't a second leg of an inducement, second critical, bless you, at the second critical phase of this, and that's worthy of our consideration.
Thank you,
Chair. Just to clarify, I don't know if you just misstated it, but the bill does, if we put the money in, we shall get an open season.
Yes.
There shall be an open season. There shall be a FERC certificate. And the question of whether or not we can get a guarantee at this point that we have put in enough on the upstream inducement side that we can guarantee that the producers are going to participate, as the commissioner said, we're chasing our tail at that point. For a couple of reasons. One is that we've been down this road before. That's what you guys spent the last year examining what the previous administration spent multiple years trying to chase, and we clearly weren't going to get there. Secondly, there isn't a project for us to be able to say this is what it's going to take to get you to participate in this project. And until we get that project identified, we just don't know what that economic picture is. And that's what we're trying to get to. We're trying to jump that gap that we currently have.
Mm-hmm. Representative Gatto, followed by Samuels.
A couple of points. One is that, you know, this has happened historically over a long time. Mr. Rockefeller had a dream of the Standard Oil Company. I'm sure he faced committees like this that said, what if? So did Bill Gates face committees. So did Mr. Carnegie face committees. But they all succeeded. And they succeeded because they believed in the free market. And I think we have the free market here because what we know is that gas at Prudhoe Bay that we're talking about here, the longer they keep it there, the less they ship oil. Because it is now will be becoming a difficult process to contain the gas and ship the oil. The oil will diminish until the gas is released. There's an incentive for the companies right there. And if the fact of the point Thompson taking added to that, I think we now have a couple of reasons for the companies to come. And if they still don't come, you're absolutely right. We still have a carrot and we still have a stick. And I hope we rely on the carrot first. And if not, we'll come up with a solution because we're not going to get along without this. And all we have to do is give them enough of a reason to want to do it, and it will happen. Now, will they come? If they do, fine. If they don't, we'll be sitting around this same table saying, now what? But I believe when we sit around this table and say, now what, we'll understand they didn't come because, and we'll figure out what to do about the because. But I'm encouraged that this act will get us where we want to go. And with it, it's only a framework, but with it, we're going to be able to meet all the rabbit trails that go left and right and figure out which ones will get us to where we want to go or not. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's hope the carrot approach works on that. Representative Samuels.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like your comments on this, too, because last year while we were discussing the oil tax, one idea that I never floated but I actually had drafted was to tie the tax rate to the open season so that if you showed up at the open season, your oil tax went down so you could make everybody happy. And once I realized that gas was going to implode, that was no longer a viable option. But the problems that I see with it now is I have thought about it this year also, and I'd like your take on this, is what if everybody showed up with half the gas? What if one company showed up with all their gas and the other two didn't? What do you do with the guys who would want to ship gas, the Anadarko, that finds gas, but they have power of Alpine? And it complicated, in an hour at home, I complicated it so much where I didn't go down the road, Jay, I could just say that. You know, and I argued myself to a standstill on how to use the tax as a leverage at the open season, and it sounds really good. You know, boy, you either show up or up goes the tax rate, and I could not find a way to make it a realistic leverage point. Now, I'd welcome your opinion. I sat at home in my living room and think about these things for every night, so I'd take your...
Through the chair, Representative Samuels, in looking at and internally debating whether or not we wanted to put anything with regard to an upstream gas component, one of the things that we were just internally
struggling... I was talking oil.
Well, I understand. And it goes to the same. I mean, it's at that open season, we're looking at, are we going to create some sort of an incentive to get them to the table or the stick? And I think you're talking more probably the stick or maybe both. You can go up or it can go down depending on whether you participate.
That was the original idea last year. That didn't work. And this year I can't even get that far without confusing myself. So
I think that what we're trying to do with the G is we're trying to set up an opportunity for primarily the commercial forces that usually play out in these things to be the primary drivers, as opposed to the government putting in a stick or a carrot to actually effectuate that decision on the upstream portion. That simply by creating a project that has firm economics, that the producers can make a reasoned decision for their own commercial benefit as to whether to participate or not. And it's not going to be driven by the external forces of government telling them one way or the other whether or not that action is going to have a penalty or reward. And so that was the premise that we ultimately came to. I think where the discussion all revolves around is, okay, what if we find out that at the end of the day, we've got a project, it appears to be economic, and that's still not enough to get them to play. And then it comes down to carrot sticks and all that kind of stuff. I think our operating assumption is that the project economic, all we need to do is have a player come into the table and move it forward to where that's proven. And then everybody will make a reasonable commercial decision and they will participate. Now we get to the what if. What if they don't? And again, I go back to my original answer. At that point, we still have as many opportunities as we have now to influence the decision that they may make, but we'll have a much greater understanding of what the gap is and why it's there and whether it's legitimate. And that will influence our decision on whether it should be a carrot or a stick, because right now we just don't know.
Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's a third player here that maybe we're not considering, and they're located about 4,000 miles away. And they have a truckload of carrots followed by a truckload of sticks. And their intent, and they have a lot of sway over what we would consider big oil. If they want this project to happen, I think there will be an awful lot of inducements and incentives to make it happen. And so we have an ally for once in the federal government. that is on the same page that we are, right after our name is their name. I think we have even more going for us than our discussion here about a single carrot and a single stick.
Thank you. Well, we've been here for 2 hours, and I see the fatigue in my colleagues' faces here. So to maintain my goodwill as the chairman, I'd like to draw this meeting to a close. So unless there's any final comments, I'd like to, and I don't see any hands going up. I thank you, commissioners, for joining us and for the membership for the good committee of give and take. The meeting is adjourned at 5:06.